Recording.
Hello, everyone. Today I'm joined by one of our production coordinators, Jody Wall, and two of our R&D chemists, Lib Forbes and Autumn Phillips. Today we're going to continue with a comprehensive review of another one of our most popular resources, our trace analysis guide written by our founder, Dr. Paul Gaines. Be sure to check out previous episodes of Bench Boost to hear our team's thought on previous chapters from this guide and a complete review of each chapter of our ICP operations guide. Today our team will be discussing Chapter 2 of the Trace Analysis Guide on planning your project. If you'd like to follow along with us, you can view the guide on our website at www.inorganicventures.com. All right, so Paul started off this chapter kind of defining routine, semi-routine, and non-routine analysis. Jody, what's when we're dealing with trace analysis in our lab, what's a routine analysis for us?
So yeah, we do a trace metals analysis on all of our new starting materials to kind of make sure it doesn't have any surprise impurities, because your starting materials obviously can vary from lot to lot. That being said, since we do it every time we get a starting material, we know exactly, this is how you set it up. These are the lines that we run. These are what you look for. We've got tons of years of data, and we're actually trying to use that data now to make life easier on our techs so that we can kind of basically figure out exactly which lines they actually need to look for, since we have years of history. If you've got all that data laying around, you might as well make it work for you, right?
Yeah, that makes sense with a routine analysis like that. Why, especially if we're characterizing just different lots of the same material over and over again, we have a pretty good idea of what should be present and what shouldn't be present, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Sometimes there's a surprise, but rarely.
Got you. Liv, how about in our lab, what's an example of like a semi-routine trace analysis that we do?
Yeah, so we do quite a few. We do like leaching studies on new containers or new tubing. Any surface that the solutions that we're making are going to touch, we try to make sure that we know what's on there. And if it is dirty, then we do have processes to clean that. And then we can verify our processes again with more leaching studies.
So do we have like a since we don't do this on the regular as much as our trace metal impurity testing for like say starting materials, do we still have a good procedure written up for this? Is there a set path that you follow every time if someone gives you a new bottle or a new glove or something to test?
Yeah, so there's definitely like a kind of like a checklist to follow when you get new materials. Make sure you're testing them, following the same procedures every time. And it also is really helpful to know, depending on like what kind of material it is, if it's a new bottle or new tubing or new gloves, what limits you're kind of worried about anyways before you go in, so when you get that data, you know what's on your material, but is it worth anything if you don't know like what you're supposed to be shooting for? So we have limits and guides and kind of vague starting or processes that you can follow to kind of fit to whatever material you're working with.
No, I think that's great. So kind of like a threshold. Mm-hmm. If it's over 10 ppb, that's when it's concerned. But if it's under, mm-hmm. not to worry, sort of thing.
Yes.
Awesome. Autumn, how about a non-routine analysis? What's that kind of look like for us? And how is that a little bit different from what Jody and Liv have spoke about?
Yeah, so a lot of times R&D is working on developing new methods or testing new sample types. So really we kind of have to start from scratch, starting with what we want the method to look like. So depending on what type of intro system you're running, if it's an ICP analysis, you're going to have to set up your timings, and you're going to have to figure out which lines are going to be the best, which ones are going to not have interferences, which ones are going to have appropriate sensitivity for the detection limits you need to reach. This was something that we had to do for a cannabis ICP OAS method. So the sample type was very different from what we are normally used to. It was an organic sample, so we had a lot of carbon in there. So we had to deal with those interferences and the suppression from the carbon. And then we had to go through when we analyzed the samples and validate this method and make sure that no contamination is being added, that we're getting the correct results, our recoveries are looking good. You have to set your background points to make sure that you're setting them in an area where you're going to get the right intensities for the wavelengths that you're looking at. So yeah, it's a lot more work that goes into it up front, but it's really necessary to make sure that you're going to get the right results for different sample types.
That's great. I think these examples that you guys just gave out, you know, give a really good insight into the next section of the chapter that, you know, Paul wrote about defining the problem. Defining the problem is really a critical part to the planning stage and can help you, you know, set up good guardrails for your project, I think, really to avoid scope creep, which is something I know in our lab we've experienced from time to time, and it's always just a hurdle to try to overcome. So I'd like to go back over a couple of the examples that you guys just gave, and just, you know, if you could sort of help define the problem. So Jody, what is normally the defined problem when we do a normal trace metal impurity analysis, say on like a new starting material, something like that?
Yeah, so you mentioned thresholds. So that's kind of your big thing, is you're looking for something that's higher than everything else, or higher than what we saw last time, or higher than what we're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. So those kind of stick out. It's a little easy because, you know, we have this huge baseline that's already well established with mm-hmm. all this data that we've collected. So it makes the ones that stand out easier.
Gaia. So like you say, that past a certain threshold, like would that cause an issue, say, if we're trying to take this product and mix it with certain other elements, that sort of thing?
Right. Well, we're kind of looking at two different things. When we do a analysis of a starting material, we've got a kind of total number, as in how pure is the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a threshold for that. Obviously, mm-hmm. we don't want something that's not close enough to its actual number. And then there's specific lines, right? So if we know that this particular product has, for whatever reason, a lithium impurity, and we're using it to make something further down the line that does have lithium in it, so that way we can kind of troubleshoot individual pieces as well. So yeah, two. You've got the whole number and then the line specific numbers.
That's great. And I know our end users like to have that data as well, because it helps them, you know, in our lab, we sort of set like those thresholds like you talked about, but for the end users, they may use the product for any number of, you know, different applications. So I think having the impurity data that we list helps them troubleshoot for any interferences they might see, or hopefully will make them feel safe that they're not going to see a signal from an interference because that impurity is not present. Liv, what's kind of the problem that we're working with when you're validating, like, you know, production critical materials like new bottles and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. So it kind of is along the same lines of what we're doing with starting materials. We want to make sure that we're not introducing a lot of contaminants into our solutions. So it's nice to know from our starting materials, like Jody mentioned, everything we're putting into solution is going to be clean and good, and we know what's going on. But it's really important that once we've got that solution made, that we're not adding any additional impurities from the bottle, or if we have to pump it through any tubing for packaging purposes, or even from the acids that we use in our matrices. So it's mostly just ensuring that we're not adding any additional stuff to the solutions that we've made.
Gaia. Perfect. Well, next up in this chapter, Paul talks about the detection limits and uncertainty, which is something we spoke about on this podcast series quite a bit in the past. So if you go back a few episodes, you should see a full episode on uncertainty. But really, I think the big thing that stands out is if you're doing trace analysis, a lot of times you're operating near the detection limit where uncertainty is not great. So one of the things that we sort of mentioned in those previous episodes is getting a good blank. And Autumn, I was going to see if you could recommend some tips for people to come up with a good blank signal.
Yeah, so definitely always run your reagent blanks. So you want to matrix match your standards, but also your blanks to your sample type as well as you can. So if there's something present, like what we dealt with in our cannabis samples, like the carbon, you want to try to matrix match for that as well as possible. And make sure you're using the same source for that starting material if possible. So if you have something like tartaric acid, you don't want to be using a starting material in your sample preps that is of a different purity than for your calibration standards, because there could be something present there that you don't have present in your reagent blanks. So One of the big things that we always recommend is to run a method blank or multiple method blanks, so that you're running your blanks all the way through the same process as your samples are being ran, and you're able to identify any contaminants that are being added, and you're making sure that those components in your blank are in the same form and have had the same history as the matrix of your samples, so that you can match that properly and have all of the same interference that you're going to be experiencing in your sample are also present in your blanks.
Awesome. I know matrix is also going to have a big impact on your detection limits as well. Liv, how does, you know, we deal with a lot of samples sometimes that have a pretty complex matrix. What do you see? How's that impact the results usually?
I think typically when the matrix is really complex, your detection limits are just not that good, and you can have a pretty high uncertainty. But if you're able to and you can dilute that matrix out, then that really can help your results and your data look a lot better.
Yeah, I think if you have the signal, mm-hmm. Trying to dilute that out really helps out quite a bit. I think the last part in this section was about calculating uncertainty. And Jody, this is something that you look at quite a bit when you're, you know, reviewing data for different lots. Any tips on how to get uncertainty a little bit lower for folks?
So I think we've found that the biggest thing that changes uncertainty, at least for us, is the intro system and the settings of your method. And Autumn mentioned your method blanks. I'm a huge believer in method blanks, multiple method blanks. If you work in a lab where, you know, your instrument is kind of dedicated and you have one process and one thing that you run all the time and things don't change a lot, it's less of a problem. But where we, you know, we change up our methods constantly here, you could run six different methods on one instrument during an 8-hour day. And it's really important to make sure that everything has kind of re-equilibrated to your changed settings. So those method blanks are really important, and just making sure that, you know, all of your timings are right, all of your temperatures are right, all of your powers are right, because these are things that can all kind of change. Mm-hmm. And that will definitely, you'll see that in your RSDs, and your RSDs will kind of help drive your uncertainty.
Awesome. Grace, I'm going to ask you to edit right here. Sorry. All right. Ready? You guys ready to go again?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry.
Okay.
Lastly, Paul put together some good steps for beginning to plan a project, and I thought maybe we could go through those, and I'll just sort of toss these out. You know, the first step he said was pick your analyte of interest, which I think that's a fairly good place to start. You definitely want to know what you're looking for. But I'll just start out to the group. Anyone want to talk about, you know, why that's such an important part, other than the obvious of, you know, you want to know what you want to know?
Yeah, so I'll take that one. So you want to know, obviously, you know what you're trying to look for, but it's important to know this beforehand when you're setting up the method, because you want to know what potential interferences you're going to have from other analytes or other components in the samples or your standards. And you also want to be able to pick a good internal standard if you're using an internal standard for the analysis, because you want something that's going to behave similarly in the plasma to your sample, so that any changes in that signal are going to be applied the correct way to your analytes as well.
Great. The next one up was sort of, you know, what is your detection limit? And Liv, you sort of mentioned earlier about using dilution to sort of help with that. If someone knows their detection limit, what is that going to help them sort of do as they're planning their project?
Oh, were you? Sorry.
Oh, you're good.
I think if you know what your detection limits are, and you also know what your thresholds are, like what the limits of contaminants or whatever you're looking for in your sample could be, then that can really help you. If you've got a tricky matrix or you need to do some dilution, it can help you figure out, you know, what's the maximum dilution that you can do to still make sure that you're not getting below that detection limit, but still not being able to see like the threshold. Like, you need those things to match up so that you can still see what you're looking for.
Got ya. Perfect. The next one Paul threw out was just sort of, you know, what is the uncertainty requirement? So Jody, you just spoke about this, about how important RSDs are. I think that's a huge impact, you know, what's going to affect your uncertainty. If someone has a spec that they're trying to hit, say they need an uncertainty of 0.5%, what would be your first sort of starting point to try to start working on that problem?
Well, you know, we talked about the routine testing and all that data that you've collected. Again, put it to work for you. Have you tested things that are kind of similar? Do you have other established settings? Do you have other established methods that you can kind of rely on? And can you go back and look at that data and maybe get a little idea of what you can expect to give you a better jumping off point, at least, so you're not just kind of taking a shot in the dark?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I would also throw out to folks as well, you know, check the uncertainty of your standard, because usually that's going to be the baseline of what, you know, if you're trying to hit a certain uncertainty, you know, say 0.5%, but your standard has an uncertainty of 1%, you're not going to be able to hit that. So, yeah, I think definitely relying on all the information you have, all the past data and everything you have is a great way to start on trying to lower uncertainties. The next point up was the chemical composition of your sample. So when I read through this, I mean, this makes me think of the matrix, you know, the matrix of your sample, which to me really points out just what are going to be the potential interferences and can you access a clean blank? And I know this is something that we see a lot of times when our customers order custom standards and they want some sort of really weird matrix. Usually like a high salt matrix or something like that. I'll just throw it out to the group. What are some of the challenges when trying to deal with those types of requests?
So one problem with that in particularly that comes to mind is if you're trying to get matrix match standards, like I said before, the source of those components really matters and the purity. Because if we're trying to matrix match a standard for you, we're going to have high purity reagents that we'll be using. And so if you're using, you know, just a regular grade starting material to matrix or to as like a stabilizing agent or something in your sample, and then you're testing versus ours that has a high purity reagent of the same kind, the impurities in your sample are going to be vastly different from what's in the calibration standard. So in cases like that where you don't have a really clean component to be in your sample as your blank in your matrix, it's better to just match that all the way through and use the dirty stuff all the way through so that you can just account for those interferences rather than having a discrepancy between the component in your sample and the component that's going to be in the standards.
The matrix of your sample also plays a big role, like especially like you mentioned, Mike, if you're running like high salt things, because especially if you're doing this like really low level analysis, you're probably running on a mass spec. And for the sake of your instrument, if you've got a really high salt matrix, you probably want to do some dilutions. And then again, you have to worry about, you know, what components are you looking for? Are they going to be below your detection limits? And having a funky matrix is going to make your detection limits a little worse anyways. So it's definitely something to keep in mind.
Definitely.
Yeah, and it can definitely cause that signal suppression as well. And so you may be getting false results. You may be getting, you're only seeing half the level that is really there because of that suppression from your high matrix.
Yeah, and kind of piggybacking on Autumn's comment about, you know, using the dirty stuff all the way through, that's definitely something we do here when we're doing our quality check on something like a weird matrix custom blend. Is we will go get the actual matrix, the actual bottle of matrix that was used to make the blend, and we will make that our blank to give us just that much better chance of seeing some of that low-level stuff.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, just making sure that you also are running that blank for a good long time before you start the analysis so that, like Jody was saying before, you can let the instrument equilibrate to the baseline of that signal. Because you could have some pretty bad drift if it hasn't equilibrated. So your initial runs are going to be different than what you get at the end when you're running your samples. So then your whole analysis is kind of screwed up. So just allowing that to run kind of constantly as the blank, and also not running cleaner rinses between, because that can screw up the signal by, you know, making it clean and then it's trying to equilibrate back to your salt matrix. So just keeping that in mind too, to keep everything as constant as possible, just so that everything remains stable.
Great. And the last section was really, you know, Paul mentioned the quantity, availability, and the history of the sample, which, Jody, you've spoken a lot about how important it is to know the history of the sample, but also as you're planning your project, the quantity can be of great importance, because you might only have enough to do one shot at this. So if that's the case, I mean, the more you plan out ahead of time, if you're really limited on sample, the better off you're going to be, because, yeah, if you only have one shot, you got to make it count. Before we close this episode out, does anyone have any final tips to help our listeners plan for any trace analysis projects they may be working on?
I would just say one good idea and one thing that I like to just start out with, if I'm running a sample that I just really am not sure what's in there and what to expect as far as matrix or other components and contaminants that might be in there, is you can run just kind of, if you have enough sample, if you run a quick scan on your instrument to get a semi-quantitative analysis, then you can kind of know what to plan for, and can plan your detection limit or your dilution factors accordingly to where you're going to get the most out of your final analysis without having to go back and redo a bunch of runs.
Yeah, you just said dilution factor, and that was the first thing that popped into my head too, is dilute. If you have no idea what it is, or if it's, you know that it's really, you know, concentrated or wacky, the lower you can, the more you can dilute all that wackiness out, the better your signals are going to be.
Yeah.
The only thing that I like can think about that we didn't really talk about is when you're doing like these trace analysis, it's really, really, really important to keep in mind, you know, what kind of contaminants are you going to be adding in while you're doing your preps or while you're worrying about like your samples and your blanks and stuff. So it's really important to make sure, you know, you're using as clean of materials as you can. You're trying not to touch as many things as you can and try to do as few steps as possible, so you're not introducing any additional contaminants to your sample or your standard or your blanks or anything that you're working with.
That's all great advice. Thank you all very much. Well, we hope you found this conversation helpful. If you have any questions, please contact us at ivyignite@inorganicventures.com. Ignite membership provides you with unlimited access to video courses, downloadable resources, community forums, and so much more. Join us next week as we review Chapter 3 of the Trace Analysis Guide, where our team will discuss sampling and subsampling. We'll hope you join us then and have a fantastic week.